Now to that I-95 missing link we mentioned. The highway disappears for a few miles near the border of Pennsylvania and New Jersey, forcing travelers to divert onto other roads. Finally, after 25 years in bureaucratic limbo, work on the final 12-mile stretch of I-95 is set to begin within weeks. We sent reporter Joel Rose out to look for the missing link.
I'm driving north on Interstate 95 between Philadelphia and New York City, and if you've ever done this, you know that I-95 disappears, confusingly, somewhere outside of Princeton, New Jersey. The original plan was for 95 to continue all the way to New York, but that never happened because of powerful local opposition.
There was a specific revulsion to tearing up a rustic community, a rural community, and putting 95 through it.
Bill Mathesius was the chief executive of Mercer County, New Jersey, in the early 1980s. Mathesius says his constituents didn't want the interstate in their backyards. Looking out across his back porch at the meadow and wooded hillside off in the distance, it's not hard to see why.
There would be fundamentally a six-lane highway going through this area with off exchanges in one or two places. Those places would have been developed.
Mathesius and his allies managed to block construction of a key stretch of Interstate 95, the so-called missing link. This was in 1982. Since Plan A didn't work, engineers decided to go with Plan B. This one doesn't involve Mercer County. Instead, the idea is to complete I-95 by connecting existing roads. So the familiar red, white, and blue badge of Interstate 95 would continue unbroken, even when it shares the road with the Pennsylvania and New Jersey turnpikes. But this plan had its issues, too.
Well, this is the crossing, so you can envision, you know, structure being pretty high. It's actually a three-level interchange with...
Jeff Davis is a project manager with the Pennsylvania Turnpike Authority. We're standing a few yards from the spot where I-95 and the Pennsylvania Turnpike cross, just north of Philadelphia. Right now, if you want to get from I-95 to the Turnpike, or vice versa, you have to drive on surface streets for 7 miles.
That's just the way things were done at that time. So we're trying to correct that.
It hasn't been easy or quick. The interchange project is complicated because both roadways are hemmed in by homes, businesses, and environmentally sensitive creeks.
As you can see here, things are all built up in this area, too, so it's very difficult to get something built without having a lot of displacements, and that's what we had to study.
After decades of preliminary designs and environmental impact studies, construction of Phase 1 is finally set to begin this fall with a price tag of more than $400 million. While Davis drives, consulting engineer Jay Roth points out where new ramps and exits will connect to the turnpike. At this point, neither of them needs a map.
I've been working on this project since 1996, personally. Jeff's got me beat, though.
1984, when we started conceptual studies.
Jeff Davis has been working on this interchange for 26 years, basically his entire professional life.
We had, some dark moments. There was actually a year where the federal funding got cut and we put the project on hold. But right now, we feel pretty confident that, you know, Stage 1 can get built.
It's a proud moment for Davis and engineer Jay Roth.
It doesn't just complete 95 from Maine to Florida. It completes the original interstate system as envisioned in 1956. So it is, you know, to me, even more symbolic for that reason.
But Roth and Davis haven't quite reached their destination yet. Even under the best case scenario, it'll be another 7 years before the final stretch of I-95 is officially redesignated and the missing link is gone for good. For NPR News, I'm Joel Rose in Philadelphia.
NPR series I-95, the road most traveled, continues tomorrow on Weekend Edition Sunday with a report about the interstate's role in the global transportation network. And we've got music to drive by, many road trips, and more on our website, npr.org/I-95. Peel out. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
For millions of Americans, I-95 is just a crowded road they have to navigate. But the interstate highway is also part of the global transportation system. It's a pipeline for goods entering the United States through the port of Savannah. Once at the port, many of the goods are hauled by truck up I-95 towards New York or down into Florida. As our series on I-95 continues, we look at Georgia's portion of the road. Just a small part runs through the state, but as NPR's Kathy Lohr reports, the economic impact is enormous.
The port of Savannah sits about 5 miles east of I-95. Some call it the quiet giant.
I guess we're here.
We head up more than 200 feet in an elevator on one of four giant cranes to get a broader view of the operation. Every day, 25,000 tons of cargo is funneled through the port.
This is the largest single container facility of its kind in all of North America, the second busiest on the East Coast next to New York, New Jersey, and the fourth busiest in the nation.
Robert Morris works for the Georgia Ports Authority. He says 7,000 to 9,000 trucks move onto and off of this facility every day. They're loaded with goods heading for retail stores across the Southeast, the Midwest, and along the Gulf Coast.
This is a major hub for, of all things, imported beer, and many of your Christmas goods are beginning to come in.
While some ports along the East Coast have struggled, the Port of Savannah continues to attract more freight. Last year, it handled 2.6 million containers. About 80% of that freight ends up here on I-95. You're hearing the constant rumble of truck traffic along I-95 near Savannah, where another important interstate also intersects, I-16. This is a major transportation logistics point along the East Coast.
It's critical. It's what makes one of our assets like the port as competitive and fast-growing as they've been for the past 8 or 10 years.
Paige Siplon is head of Georgia's Center of Innovation for Logistics. He says Georgia's ports at Savannah and Brunswick provide nearly 300,000 jobs in the state.
Having that infrastructure and having that connectivity connects us into other parts of the world that have huge population centers like New York and California. It's about the most efficient and, most importantly, the most reliable route to get your cargo you want it where you want it to be.
Some of the largest companies have set up distribution centers at this junction on I-95, including Home Depot, IKEA, and Walmart. But smaller companies have also built their business around this corridor. Billy Robinson is the CEO of Port City Logistics.
You know, we're a public warehouse, so unlike a Home Depot or a Target, we deal with anybody's stuff. So what you're seeing is a wide variety.
Robinson says his company has three warehouses, nearly 1 million square feet of space to store merchandise. On a tour, we see paper products, boxes of flavoring to be added to Starbucks coffee, and Heineken beer, which has just come in from the port. All of this is unloaded, repackaged, and shipped out as needed to the southeastern states. And most of it travels at least part of the way on I-95.
Yeah, 95's key. It's a huge key.
I mean, you guys are really dependent on these major interstates.
Yeah, our customers wouldn't come here without them. Oh, it's our business wouldn't work without them.
One of the vital selling points for Robinson's business is the proximity to the road. And in the next few months, Georgia will be the first state in the Southeast to finish its expansion of I-95. It will accommodate three lanes of traffic in each direction from South Carolina to Florida. Todd Long with the Georgia Department of Transportation says the state has spent over $1 billion in the last 15 years to widen I-95.
And that's a lot of money. And, you know, even today in 2010, that's almost worth an entire capital program for the entire state invested in one corridor. I would rate it up there as one of the most important interstates we have in the whole country.
Georgia made I-95 a priority in part because of the high volume of freight traffic, but also because so many tourists use the interstate. And it's a vital evacuation route that funnels people out of Florida in case of a hurricane. Kathy Lohr, NPR News.
NPR's series I-95, The Road Most Traveled, continues on the next weekend edition Saturday with a report on how the road shaped development in Florida. And if you're driving on I-95, we've got some stops you shouldn't miss. Head to our site, npr.org/I-95.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
I'm Melissa Block, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. today, how the internet is transforming how baby boomers care for their aging parents. As part of her series, Aging at Home, NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports on new technology that's designed to help you keep tabs on mom and dad.
When Lida Lee Bridger's mother had a stroke a few years back, Bridgers and her husband moved in with her in Austin, Texas, but that left them housebound.
She was not very steady on her feet and kind of doing the surfing the furniture type thing, and so we were real reluctant to leave her alone.
Bridger's husband, Chris, was in IT, so he set up some motion sensors and linked them to a computer. The Bridgers were worried about her falling, especially in the bathroom.
If she was in the bathroom more than 30 minutes, it would send a text message on our cell phone.
From that, a business grew. This year, the couple launched Adaptive Home, one of a growing number of startups betting on a big market as the baby boomers enter old age. Chris Bridger says a basic package includes about a dozen motion sensors placed strategically around a house. They can provide adult children with a stunningly detailed rundown of a parent's day.
They may know that their mother got up in the morning, that she's been to the kitchen, she's opened the refrigerator, she's taken her medicine.
The sensors can even note when mom makes her coffee and sits in her favorite chair. The idea is to alert children with a phone call or text message when anything unusual happens. Of course, there have been bumps. Some clients insist they're sound asleep all night.
Come to find out they're out of bed for 2 hours at night doing whatever. They're in the kitchen and the bathroom.
The refrigerator was open.
And the refrigerator was open like 3 times from 2 to 4 a.m. And the kids, you know, they don't need alerts for that because Grandpa wants a glass of milk.
Well, it's frightening to me. It's like Orwell.
Nancy Schlossberg is a counseling psychologist who focuses on seniors. She wonders if all this monitoring really means it's time to consider assisted living. But if a family goes the high-tech route, Schlossberg hopes they ask mom and dad first.
It is really important not to feel marginalized, not to feel degraded because you are old. So if the technology can make you feel good about yourself, that's fine. If it is a way of looking at you, inspecting you, then it isn't so good.
Welcome to the Age Lab.
Joe Coughlin heads the Age Lab at MIT, where researchers are coming up with all kinds of new things to monitor. Coughlin is deploying the same technology NASA uses to track supplies in the space station.
You can go onto a web browser and find out exactly what's in mom's kitchen, or what medication has been taken or not taken.
The key is tiny radio frequency tags, which Earthbound retailers already use for inventory. These would signal when a parent picked up, say, a particular bottle of medicine. Of course, that doesn't mean Dad actually took those pills, so Coughlin's developing a smart trash can to track what's thrown out. He says this could also help monitor whether mom's eating enough good meals, since nutrition is a common problem for elderly living alone. Moving on to the bathroom, MIT professor Ali Devek envisions sensors on toothbrushes.
There are even piezoelectric sensors that could measure how much pressure did you apply to the toothbrush when you brushed your teeth.
Sound like way too much information? Well, Coughlin says it can help get beyond simply reacting to a crisis.
Where we're moving is predictive. A change in your walk, a change in the time that you've made coffee or tea may indicate that you're not feeling well. So the idea is to be able to intervene before you fall, before you have an issue.
And that, says Coughlin, can help keep a loved one on their own even longer. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News.
And now it's time for Back Talk, where we lift the curtain on what's happening in the blogosphere and get a chance to hear from you, our Tell Me More listeners. Producer Lee Hill, our digital media guy, joins me here in the studio as usual. Hey, Lee, what's up?
Hey, Michelle. Well, I think it's fair to say this week's parenting conversation made a lot of jaws drop, and it definitely inspired people to get online and share their feedback. Tuesday, we talked to a group of moms who share a unique experience. They were mistaken for the nannies of their multiracial or simply different-looking children. Here's a clip from that conversation with featured mom Jamila Bay.
I am African American. That's incredibly obvious, especially if you're looking at my hair.
My husband is Caucasian. My son, he's got blonde hair and gray-blue eyes. I was in an elevator one day. He was in a stroller, and a woman looked at him and said, oh, so beautiful, so beautiful. Are you looking for more work? And she said, oh, well, you know, you're just so good with him. And when I realized what she was asking, it hurt.
And as you might imagine, in response to that conversation, we received quite a bit of feedback. Here's a note we received from listener Ingrid. She writes, I'm white. My husband is Ethiopian. Our three children are grown now, but when they were young, I was sometimes asked where I had gotten my children and complimented for having helped children in need.
Oh, me.
Oh, well, wow.
But other listeners, like Michael, had a different message. He writes, good God, people, toughen up. It's a hard world, and getting questioned if you are a nanny for a baby of a different color than you is hardly anything to get worked up over. He goes on to write, I'm white. My wife is black. Our child is also black. I have been questioned and could care less about what people think. Thank you, Michael. And continuing on the parenting theme, this week we talked about the rising popularity of sperm donation as a means for forming a family. And we spoke with one child who was conceived through sperm donation, and she talked about how she feels that experience has affected her life. Following that conversation, our producer Alicia Montgomery penned something for the Tell Me More blog about her decision to choose a sperm donor as a means of conceiving her child. Quite a few people also wrote to us about that. Here's a post from commenter Camila. She writes, I'm 30 years old and have not had much luck finding a loving husband, yet I believe experiencing motherhood is my destiny. If I don't get married in the next 5 years, I intend to have a family without a father. As long as my children will grow up in a household of love with plenty of family and friends to support and mentor them, I know they will turn out fine. I grew up without a father, and I grew into an educated, productive member of society. Thanks, Camila. Lee, what else?
Last week on the program, we discussed the celebrity buzz surrounding the war crimes trial of former Liberian leader Charles Taylor. Now, the case involves his alleged trading of so-called blood diamonds, and it stirred quite a frenzy when supermodel Naomi Campbell testified about diamonds she received. We learned that Jeremy Ratcliffe, head of former South African President Nelson Mandela's Children's Fund, confessed he's been in control of the diamonds since 1997. That's when Campbell gave them to him, she says, because she wanted them to go to charity. Well, yesterday, Ratcliffe resigned from his post and turned the gems over to South African police.
And Lee, we also have more news about Shirley Sherrod. She's the former USDA official who was forced to resign last month after her comments about overcoming racial prejudice were used out of context during the firestorm in which she lost her job. She was initially blasted by some in the media, her superiors at the Obama administration, and the NAACP. Well, this week, Sherrod officially made peace with the civil rights organization. In an open letter, she wrote, quote, that's behind us, and the last thing I want to see happen is for my situation to weaken support for the NAACP. Interesting.
Very interesting development.
Thank you, Lee.
Thanks, Michelle.
And remember, with Tell Me More, the conversation never ends. To weigh in with your own thoughts, you can call our comment line at 202-842-3522. Again, that's 202-842-3522. Please remember to leave your name. And you can also go to our website to read what other listeners are saying and to add your own comments. Log on to npr.org, click on Programs, then on Tell Me More, and blog it out.
Is nothing sacred. These days, even pogo sticking's gone extreme. Athletes now compete on turbocharged tubes that catapult them into the air. Jenny Brundine from member station KUER reports on this year's Pogo Palooza Festival in Salt Lake City.
What's that kid doing?
He's hopping on a hop rod.
In the summer of 72, my brother Mike was like the kid in this pogo stick commercial, a hopping fool. He swears he broke the world record for most consecutive jumps. That coil spring pogo stick was the coolest thing we could imagine. Just bouncing up and down. That was enough. Fast forward 30 years. Fred Grzybowski gets a pogo stick for Christmas.
Just jumping up and down is like, why?
It didn't make sense to Grzybowski, who grew up in the era of extreme sports. He saw potential. He started doing tricks like spins and jumping without hands.
I thought, like, I invented this new thing. Oh, extreme pogoing. And then I looked online.
And he found a small group of kids who thought they had invented the sport. The kids began swapping tricks on YouTube, and soon the technology caught up. Some of today's high-performance sticks are filled with compressed air, like this one. Others contain fiberglass or giant rubber bands, and they send jumpers flying.
Everybody that's here, thank you, and welcome to Pogo Palooza 7.
The world's only extreme pogo sticking competition is held in a different city each year. At the preliminary rounds on Friday, 30 of the world's best bouncers are competing in four categories: big air, tech, best trick, and high jump, which this year could clear 9.5 feet.
When you're up in the air, it feels like you're flying.
14-year-old Dalton Smith is the youngest competitor. Kids seem to retire around 21.
You gotta quit before you die, I guess.
The sport is risky. The jumpers twist and flip and wipe out a lot. They stop for a few seconds now and again, exhausted. One of the most tiring is this event called Most Jumps in a Minute.
The pogo stick must completely leave the ground to count as a bounce on every bounce.
The crowd appears incredulous as they watch a skinny young man who looks like he's jackhammering. On other tricks, judges look for originality, height, execution, and good landings. Pogo Palooza co-founder Nick Ryan says his goal for extreme pogo sticking is respect.
I want to see it become a staple of culture in the same way that skateboarding is and BMX is.
But he concedes the sport has a ways to go.
If you just tell someone like, oh, I'm an extreme pogo athlete, people laugh. Of course people laugh. I would laugh.
But the crowds will be cheering today when they crown this year's pogo champions. For NPR News, I'm Jenny Brundine in Salt Lake City.
This is NPR News.
We're reporting this week on ways to help people stay in their homes as they grow older. You've seen that lady in the television commercial with the panic button around her neck?
I've fallen, and I can't get up!
We're sending help immediately, Mrs. Fletcher.
Well, high-tech monitoring has come a long way. As NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports, there is a growing market in technology that lets adult children keep an eye on their parents 24 hours a day.
It's dinner time in Savannah, Georgia. Colleen Hendry is bringing food to her parents' ranch house.
Oops, not long.
Her mother's watching TV.
Hey, Mama.
Colleen heads to the kitchen to dish out meatloaf, mashed potatoes, green beans, and squash. Her mom suffers brain damage from a stroke. With her dad's health failing as well, Colleen's been helping out more and more in recent years.
Now, here's your ketchup. And there's your salt shaker.
Edward and Lavinia Fitzgerald settle around the table. It's a normal dinner scene, but for one thing, there's actually an extra guest at this meal.
No, that's Denise. That's our goodest friend.
She's waving at you.
Yeah.
Denise Cady is waving from a computer monitor that sits just next to the kitchen table.
And how's the weather down there?
Couldn't beat it with a stick.
Oh, my goodness.
That's good.
Denise is what's called a tele-caregiver, and for 2 years, she's been checking on the Fitzgeralds every evening from way up in Lafayette, Indiana. She joins in mealtime chatter, just like a friend who's dropped by. She asks after family and neighbors. She takes it in stride when Colleen's mom, Lavinia, gets the sillies, as she often does.
Lavinia, you are really tickled right now.
You might think this isn't so strange. Lots of people use the computer to Skype with far-flung relatives. But it turns out Denise can see almost every move the Fitzgeralds make. Their house is wired with video cameras, like something out of a sci-fi movie, though you can't tell at first.
They have one of the cameras right there.
Oh, I see. It's in like an enclosed bubble in the ceiling.
Yeah, that's it.
I see it turning now.
You can actually hear the camera swivel. There's one in the front that shows who comes in the door. It can pan down a hall to show who goes into the bathroom and bedroom, but it can't see into those rooms. A second camera surveys the living room, dining room, and kitchen. Colleen admits the notion made her wary.
Well, at first I was thinking all sorts of things. My dad sitting around in his underwear, my mother. I just thought, oh my God, these people are going to see everything. You know, and that part of it bothered me.
But after her mom broke her ankle 2 years ago, Colleen became overwhelmed with the duties of caring for her aging parents, and she worried constantly when she wasn't with them.
I know that the burden's on me if something happened.
Desperate for help, Colleen discovered a new video monitoring service and signed them up. It's turned out to be a huge relief for her dad as well. As with many elderly spouses, his wife's condition has thrown Edward into the exhausting role of full-time caregiver. Now, with the cameras on, he can get out of the house for daily mass and a gab session with his buddies at McDonald's.
We go down there and we sit around and talk, and that telephone will ring, and I'm on my way. I'm home in 5 minutes.
Denise or another telecaregiver call Edward's cell phone if they notice Lavinia staying in the bathroom a bit too long. They've called when, in fact, she has fallen and couldn't get up. They also alert Colleen and even call in the middle of the night if something seems wrong.
They're diligent. They're on the ball. And I like it.
What about this high-tech invasion of his privacy? Edward says he never actually worried about it.
That wouldn't bother me. What worried me more than anything else is bringing strangers into your house.
Strangers do come in. A home health aide gets Lavinia bathed and dressed every day. Colleen says she's grateful the cameras can monitor the quality of that care.
Amen, Brother Ben. Mm-hmm. Make a rhyme every time.
Looks good. Are those fresh greens?
The company that's monitoring the Fitzgerald house is called ResCare. Here's the dinner scene from their offices in Indiana.
Amen, Brother Ben.
Oh, looks good. Are those fresh green beans?
Yes, they are.
Telecaregiver Denise Cady sits before two large computer screens. On one, she sees the Fitzgeralds. Cady can also see thumbnail video images of 24 other homes. She'll check on each one over the course of her shift. Clients' children could log into the same video Denise watches and monitor parents themselves. This long-distance care isn't cheap. ResCare services start at $600 a month and can run well over $1,000 depending on how much active monitoring is needed. But that's still a lot less than the average nursing home.
Primarily the people that are using this at this time are those that are in the beginning stages of Alzheimer's or dementia.
ResCare spokesperson Nell Taylor says a telecaregiver can remind someone to take their medication at a certain time. They can alert a relative if someone appears confused or in distress. They can also help with the simple tasks of daily life, like the time a client was about to sit down to breakfast.
And the telecaregiver zoomed in on the frying pan and said, maybe you ought to cook the sausage and the eggs a little longer. The eggs look kind of runny and the sausage is pink.
No doubt, starring in your own daily reality show won't appeal to everyone. But there are all kinds of remote monitoring systems popping up to keep tabs on a fast-aging population. Most use motion sensors, and they alert children to every mundane detail of a parent's day. When they get in and out of bed, sit on the sofa, open the refrigerator door, turn on the AC. ResCare's Taylor says all the research and startup companies are driven by this simple equation.
At the same time that we have this huge population of aging folks, we have a shrinking population of caregivers, of younger people who are able to provide the care that these older people are going to need. And if we don't find other ways, then we are really going to be in big trouble in the future.
This is for you for later.
Okay.
In Savannah, Colleen scoops out some extra banana pudding for her parents to snack on.
I was going to leave the whole dish, but I thought better of it, Denise.
It would be gone by tomorrow morning, I'm telling you.
Colleen says she figured video monitoring would help her parents stay healthy and at home. She had no idea they would also gain a friend.
You see how old people, they're just lonely. And this makes Mom and Daddy happy. So I was happy about that aspect. You know, it makes me not so feel so guilty when I run in. Here's your dinner. I'm out of there.
As Denise and the Fitzgeralds keep chatting, Colleen gathers her dishes.
All right. I'll see you tomorrow. Bye.
She leaves her parents for the night, reassured that they're not really alone. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News.
You can see what that video from the Fitzgeralds house looks like at our website, nbr.org. And this evening on All Things Considered, Jennifer reports on houses designed with aging in mind.